No issue is more controversial and confusing than the right to free speech, especially when it's pitted against the desire of people not to feel attacked or hated simply because of their race, gender, or sexual orientation. Nadine Strossen, who served as the president of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008, is the author of the new book, Hate: Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. The book lays out a compelling argument against laws and policies that try to restrict what individuals are allowed to say. Strossen is the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, and in 1978, the organization she would go on to lead famously defended the rights of neo-Nazis to march through Skokie, a Chicago suburb with a large Jewish population. Many residents of Skokie were survivors of German death camps who argued that the psychic pain of a Nazi rally would be brutally upsetting and could lead to violence. As the ACLU's brief in that case noted, the arguments for stopping the march were the exact same as those made 10 years earlier by the residents of Cicero, Illinois, who sued to stop Martin Luther King from leading a civil rights demonstration in their town. Strossen is now a professor at New York Law School in Manhattan. She sat down recently with Reason to talk about her new book, Why Hyperpolarization in American Politics Makes Free Speech Even More Difficult, and what are the best ways to counter bad, stupid, and hate-filled speech.
Nadine Strossen, thanks for talking to Reason.
I'm delighted to be here.
So, what form do hate speech laws take today, and why should we be worried about them?
In the United States, we do not allow speech to be censored merely because its message is deemed to be hateful or hated by those who wield power. However, speech with a hated or hateful message, along with speech that conveys any other message, may be punished if in a certain context it directly causes specific imminent serious harm, such as a true threat or intentional incitement of imminent
punishable
violence.
Incitement. So if you say, as there was a famous case, there's a white guy, let's go get him.
Exactly.
That's different. If you can write,
I can clarify, it's different from the way we use inciting rather loosely in everyday speech. It's an appropriately strict standard. Right. The speaker has to intend to incite imminent violence or lawless conduct that is likely to happen imminently.
So, and this is like you can write like Hitler was great on a brick. That might be objectionable, but it's not hate speech. If you throw that brick through somebody's window, that's a punishable crime.
It could be a so-called hate crime or bias crime. Unlike hate speech, hate crime or bias crime is an acceptable legal concept. And what it means is you take something that would be a crime otherwise, apart from its message. Your example of throwing a brick is at least property damage and probably assault as well. If the government can show that that victim of the crime was singled out for a discriminatory reason, such as race, religion, or so forth, then it can be treated as a hate crime or bias crime and subject to a stiffer penalty on the theory that it causes more harm both to the victim and to society. But I would be careful.
You're exactly
right.
A separate issue. Might come back to that. But so hate speech laws, what are the form that these hate speech laws, using your context of constitutionally protected hate speech, what's going on with hate speech laws?
So in the United States, even though the Supreme Court has consistently struck down laws that punish speech based on its hateful content, and I have to stress, the Supreme Court justices across the entire ideological spectrum, from left to right, have agreed that that is a bedrock principle of freedom of speech. We can't punish it just because we despise the viewpoint. Nonetheless, like a lot of human rights principles and civil liberties principles, this one is honored in the breach in many contexts. So we have many college campuses that actually are enforcing hate speech codes for all practical purposes. They don't label them as such anymore ever since the ACLU and FIRE and others have successfully challenged every single hate speech code. But under the guise of rules about civility on campus or very distorted, exaggerated concepts of harassment, racial and gender harassment, colleges are, in fact, punishing ideas merely because they are offensive and cause students to be or faculty be uncomfortable.
And you mentioned the legal scholar Mary Matsuda, who at various points has proposed banning messages that carry messages of racial inferiority. So that's the type of thinking you're talking about.
Exactly. Where, yeah. And so the court, although people do use the term hate speech to decry whatever speech they dislike, everything from revenge porn to so-called fake news. I think the core concept is speech that conveys discriminatory stereotypes on the basis of certain personal characteristics, such as race, religion, gender, and so forth.
One of the fascinating things that I think one of the real contributions that you make is that you remind us in the book, which is concise, but is like incredibly deep, this isn't the first rodeo about hate speech and about trying to ban speeches. And so you go back and you look at places where hate speech laws were put in place and they end up harming the very people they were supposedly trying to protect. Mm-hmm. And you talk about a 1965 British law that was designed to go after a neo-Nazi group, mm-hmm. and it ended up being used to punish the Anti-Nazi League. Mm-hmm. How common is that where, you kind of get hoist on your own petard?
It's all hate speech laws, like all laws, are disproportionately enforced against those who lack political power in a democratic society. It's not surprising. Just the way the drug laws are disproportionately enforced against young, dark-skinned men. And the problem is even more acute, Nick, when we're talking about hate speech laws, because the concept is inherently irreducibly subjective. Hate is an emotion. And what one person hates, somebody else loves. We see that, in today's society, for example, many politicians and other powerful people have denounced Black Lives Matter advocacy as hate speech against white people or against police officers. It's even been accused of causing assassinations of police officers, whereas other people denounce Blue Lives Matter as hate speech, or All Lives Matter as hate speech. So given this inevitable subjectivity, those who enforce the law really have unfettered discretion to enforce their own values about what is hateful and what is dangerous and so forth. And they're not good. They're accountable to the majority. They're not likely to enforce those laws to the benefit of dissenters or minority groups.
You mentioned a case, a late 1980s case at the University of Michigan, where for, I guess, 1 or 2 years, they had a hate speech law in place, and it was used to punish a Black grad student who thought homosexuality was a mental illness, and he developed, as part of a project, like a way basically to convert gays to heterosexuality. So you're saying that's more, it's not just like, oh, that happens on the fringes. That almost always happens.
And not only does it almost always happen, Nick, and there are many examples that are going on today in Europe and Canada and all the other countries that do enforce hate speech laws, democratic countries. In the totalitarian, authoritarian countries, it's blatantly singling out their political opponents. But the fact that this happens really follows from the analysis of those who advocate hate speech laws. They argue that we live in a society that has endemic problems of structural and systemic racism, including and other forms of discrimination, including in the criminal justice system. I agree with that critique. They argue that all of us living in this society and culture are subject to unintended bias, unconscious bias. I agree. Therefore, I completely reject the vaunted solution of handing over to that discriminatory system and discriminatory individuals the power to pick and choose according to their own values and the values of the majority which speech is going to be silenced. And one of the interesting things that I learned from doing this book, because I'm so used to being accused of American exceptionalism, which, by the way, if we're exceptional in our defense of free speech, I wear that criticism like a badge of honor. But I thought what was so interesting is that so many human rights activists in other countries that enforce hate speech laws have become so critical of those laws as they see how ineffective they are at best and counterproductive at worst in terms of the very human rights goals and equality goals they were hoping to advance.
Your book focuses on government censorship, and let's talk about that briefly and then talk about these intermediary spaces that are where it gets more confusing.
Yes.
But one case that you mention is a California high school student who, I and I'm assuming it was at a public school,
yes.
but he wore a T-shirt saying homosexuality is shameful, and then he quoted the Romans, the verse from Romans in the New Testament. So at a public school, at a private school, we might say, okay, you know, it's up to the school to decide. They're not bound by the First Amendment. At a public school, is that hate speech or protected speech? Or, you know, where do you go with that?
Well, first of all, in a landmark Supreme Court decision in 1969, Tinker versus Des Moines School District, I'm so proud the ACLU represented Mary Beth Tinker, the Supreme Court held famously that the Constitution does not stop at the schoolhouse gate. Both teachers and students have freedom of speech, and their speech is protected under the same broad standards that apply in the general public sphere. So only if the speech is directly threatening material and substantial disruption of the educational process or of rights of others may it be suppressed.
And so can I say in the Tinker case, which was about the draft, about the Vietnam War, and what they were Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists?
No, they were like Unitarians or some kind of...
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Why do we even let them practice religion?
They were Quakers. They were Quakers.
But they wore black armbands in protest. If they had been wearing a shirt that said, like, fuck LBJ or fuck the draft, they might have been able to be censored if that caused the disruption.
I personally think that under the Tinker test, that speech would be protected. But what you may be thinking of is that ever since Tinker, which was the high watermark of the Supreme Court's protection of student speech, to use the water metaphor, the court has been watering down that standard. And in one subsequent case, over a strong and persuasive dissent, the court said that the school could censor speech in schools if it was indecent. And they might think that the word fuck is indecent, although in another case, interestingly enough, the Supreme Court upheld the right of a college student to wear a jacket in a courthouse that said, fuck the draft. And in an opinion by a conservative member of the court, Justice Harlan, he said it's specious to think that you are just going after one word. The word conveys a particular idea. So I think if we were faithful to Tinker, that should also be protected.
All right. Well, you know, your book focuses on...
But we didn't get back to Joshua's T-shirt.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
No. So, well, what about the T-shirt, you know, homosexuality is a sin?
So that is expressing an opinion. It may be an opinion that's offensive to some people, but it is no more offensive than Mary Beth Tinker's armband that was protesting the Vietnam War in the case...
I agree with Mary Beth. I don't agree with Joshua.
It doesn't matter. You know, the fact is that we have freedom of speech for even ideas that we strongly disagree with and hate until they satisfy that standard of, in the school context, substantially disrupting the educational process. And in Tinker, the facts occurred in the mid-1960s. I was in Minnesota, a school kid at the same time, so I can attest that being opposed to the war in Vietnam in the mid-60s in the upper Midwest was something that was profoundly upsetting and provocative to classmates and teachers and others who had relatives that were fighting in the war and getting killed in the war. So the school was not irrational when they posited not only that this would be offensive, but it might well lead to violent attacks and fisticuffs, to use that quaint term that the court used. And the court said, no, the speculation that there might be some kind of violence is not enough of a justification. The fact that people's emotions and psyches are going to be upset is not enough of a justification.
You are talking about a really different America then, right? Where it seems that feelings are second as opposed to first in a lot of these cases.
But fortunately, we're not talking about a very different Supreme Court, Nick. In the last Supreme Court decision on hate speech, which was the summer of 2017, a court which is so deeply fractured on most constitutional law issues, 9-0, resoundingly struck down a hate speech law that happened to be buried in the federal trademark statute that said the government is not going to trademark a term that it is deemed by the government bureaucrats to be disparaging or demeaning.
And that was the Washington Redskins?
No.
Or
that's
Slants.
Relevant.
It was the Slants. Yeah, an Asian American rock band.
And, you know, it has historically been a derogatory term, but in this context, it was chosen by Simon Tim, an Asian American rock musician, and he and his band members, who were also Asian Americans, were obviously choosing the term to affirm their pride in their ethnic heritage. And 9-0, I think what's so interesting about that case is it shows that hate speech laws not only stifle individual liberty, but they also stifle equality, right? To tell this Asian American group that they couldn't affirm their pride in their ethnic heritage through their chosen language, to me, violates their equal rights as well as their individual liberty.
Your book focuses a lot on government censorship for a lot of reasons, but you also talk about how much of our speech and expression now takes place in either private places like workplaces or private schools, things like that, or kind of semi-private situations, online intermediaries like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. When Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, testified before Congress recently, he talked a lot about how great, you know, how important it was for Facebook to police hate speech. Mm-hmm. You talk a lot about how Facebook, though, has done a lot of stuff that ends up hurting the minorities mm-hmm. that it seems to be protecting. Mm-hmm. And you tend to argue, or you argue kind of, if I'm reading it right, your first argument is that, you know, basically private places should adopt robust First Amendment speech restrictions. Why is that?
Okay, so first of all, I have to explain to your listeners what you obviously know, but most people don't, that the First Amendment, along with most constitutional rights guarantees, has no binding effect at all on any private sector entities, including private sector campuses and certainly these online powerful companies. That does not mean that we should not use other tools to try to secure free speech values when they exercise so much practical power, whether we in fact have free exchange of ideas or not. So I and others have been trying to advocate against suppression of hate speech even on Facebook and so forth, even though they're facing enormous political and public pressure to do the opposite. But how Facebook, for example, has enforced its hate speech rules, to me, Nick, is a textbook illustration of the inevitable problems, how inevitably vague and subjective the standards are, leading to results that are arbitrary and capricious at best, outright discriminatory at worst.
You talk about how they ended up banning LGBT groups that use the words dyke and fag, which can, you know, oftentimes get kind of like the Slants, the band name will be taken on by a group after being castigated as such. They use it as a form of empowerment, or they're talking about, you know, things that they've been called that they're not comfortable with.
So that counter speech, calling out the hate speech for purposes of denouncing the hate mongers and offering support to its victims, has been censored. Now, I have to say, in its defense, Facebook responds to these criticisms, and I saw that recently they said they are revising their standards so that they will try to protect instances of hateful messages being repeated for denunciatory purposes. But you look at the standards, which, by the way, I think Facebook did recently publish them. Last summer, ProPublica got a trove of these criteria, and I should put the word standards in quotation marks, because the examples are, they would be laughable, except that it's no laughing matter. So Facebook said, if you're talking, and it says it to this army of thousands of people around the world who are enforcing these criteria, that if you're talking about immigrants to a country, because they take each group by group about what you can say and what you can't say, I'm talking about speech codes, I mean, about immigrants, you may use the adjective filthy about them, but you may not use the noun filth about them. You may say things about them that are degrading, but you may not say things about them that are dehumanizing. So
Okay. Well, that clears that up.
That clears it up, yeah.
But on another level, like, how difficult is it? Facebook is also, I mean, you know, they're a business. Twitter is a business. Mm-hmm. You know, and if they get a huge amount of feedback saying, like, hey, I don't want to go on there and you know, hear this kind of talk. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, what, you know, you're making an argument that they should afford broad First Amendment protections all over the place. But then what if that hurts their business model?
Yeah. So, you know, I completely agree that this is a very difficult area, which is why I just, you know, skim the surface in my book. And I think realistically, this deserves a lot of thought. I do believe that as a business, they have the prerogative to be responsive to their shareholders. But I think that behooves the rest of us to be very conscious of that and use whatever power we have to push back as consumers. And some people now are arguing that, well, we need to push for the development of alternative social media that will perhaps be nonprofit and truly be responsive.
Or like Facebook Blue, where you can say whatever you want, right?
Yeah, I mean, Facebook originally purported to be, and Twitter and others, that, you know, so much in favor of free speech. I think one of the good things that's happening now is people are becoming aware of these problems. I have to say, going back to 2014, a large coalition of civil rights and civil liberties organizations, almost 80 organizations, including the ACLU, have been repeatedly complaining to Facebook that it is discriminatorily enforcing its hate speech standards so that it's disproportionately taking down critics of government policies, including abuses within the criminal justice system, including Black Lives Matter activists, including pipeline protesters and other dissidents.
One of the arguments in the book, a large argument, is that these laws are, you know, fundamentally incoherent because it becomes so subjective that it, you know, it's ridiculous to try and define hate speech in any kind of stable way. Another is that these laws hurt the people that the speech rights of people who they're supposed to protect. Then you also talk at a certain point, what chapter six is, the title is, does constitutionally protected hate speech actually cause the feared harms? Mm-hmm. What do you find in that? So, I mean, because one of the arguments, and this goes back to people like Mary Matsuda, saying, you know, if you are in a minority group or you're in a targeted group that is constantly being told, you know, you're dumber than other people, you're slower than other people, you're more crime prone, you're ugly, you know, that has a real effect on people. What did you find when you looked at the literature about the harm of hate speech?
First of all, I do have to underscore two points about Matsuda and others who were pioneers in making the argument about the psychic and emotional harms of hate speech. I sincerely thank and acknowledge them in the book because I think they drew our attention to not only psychic impacts, but also physiological and adverse impacts on free speech. If you feel so humiliated and disempowered, you are going to be stunned into silence. So those are serious concerns.
Or pushed into weird violence, right?
I mean, yes,
where you,
yes,
yeah, it's very...
Exactly, yeah. However, I do have to point this out, Nick, before directly answering your question, and that is that the argument usually stops there. I mean, even if we assume for the sake of argument that hate speech inevitably caused harms, it doesn't necessarily follow that censoring it is the right path to reduce those harms, because censorship may be, and I argue, as we've already discussed, that it is at best ineffective and counterproductive, and moreover, that counter speech and other non-censorial approaches are more effective. So my argument does not rest on only refuting the asserted harms.
But let me address that
I think that the difference between speech, or a major difference between speech and other non-expressive conduct, is that speech cannot directly cause harm. It may potentially cause harm, but only through the intermediating processes of the human mind, right? So I quote Eleanor Roosevelt in my book saying,
no one can make you feel inferior without your consent.
Exactly. Yeah. And many social psychologists and mental health experts are saying that you are not inevitably demeaned just because somebody says something hateful about you. And cognitive behavior therapists and other experts say we can and should teach ourselves and teach our young students from a very early age to have the habits of mind and attitudes and resilience that they can withstand the slings and arrows of hateful language. And
Well, this gets to your, to the final message of, mm-hmm. and you were alluding to it, where, the proper response in your, the cultural response mm-hmm. is to create a more robust society where mm-hmm. we can take this and we can argue with more counter speech and things like that. What are some of the best ways to address what people think of as hate speech rather than, just having the government say, okay, you're not allowed to say that?
And I think we can see many examples today. I think today it's hate mongers, for example, in Charlottesville, who are the ones that are disparaged and looked down upon. You have to look at the particular context. Whatever the potential harm is that you think the speech could cause, you can nip that in the bud. So if you're concerned about the feeling and the self-confidence and the self-respect of people who are disparaged, you can support them, you can argue in favor of their equality, you can denounce the ideas of the haters. If you're concerned about the hate mongers potentially recruiting college students and others to be supporters, you reach out to those people. Sometimes not necessarily through rational arguments, because as we've been reading through some celebrated cases, it might have to do with something completely different, such as lack of friends and being subject to bullying. But there are just remarkable examples online and elsewhere of people who, just ordinary members of the community, as well as psychological experts who have reached out to even confirmed hate mongers, even leaders of alt-right type white supremacist groups, and have weaned them away from those beliefs and from that conduct. There's a whole organization, one of many examples I could cite, called Life After Hate, which was founded and is staffed by people who, in the prime of their life for many years, were members of hate groups themselves and have come to see the light.
You mentioned a 1984 incident at Harvard where a fraternity circulated a misogynistic pamphlet. Derek Bach, who was the president of Harvard at the time, said he wasn't going to punish these guys, mm-hmm. but he was also not going to let it pass unnoticed. Mm-hmm. Why was that an exemplary response for you to how to deal with this kind of thing?
I liked that Derek Bach example, and there were others in his administration, because he acknowledged the potentially chilling effect on speech of somebody in such a position of authority as a university president. And he said, so he bent over backwards to stress that there would be absolutely no adverse consequence for the students who expressed the misogynistic or other hateful views. But he also said, I have a responsibility as the leader of an institution that rejects those values to make it clear that there is no implicit endorsement to the contrary. So he was, both messages were equally important. It really comes down to that famous statement attributed to Voltaire. I disagree with what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. But I'm also exercising my free speech rights, especially as the leader of this community, to make clear on behalf of the university as a whole that we reject the substance of the message, not your right to say it.
You're a free speech absolutist, and that, of course, comes with certain constraints on it. But you also at one point suggest that trigger warnings are a good idea. This is something when you read discourse, especially people on the right and a lot of libertarians mm-hmm. who are free speech advocates, mm-hmm. they're always like, oh, trigger warnings. Mm-hmm. This is, these are snowflakes. This is the problem. Mm-hmm. Why are trigger warnings a good idea?
Well, that's an overgeneralization, yeah. Nick. So first of all, if trigger warnings are mandated by somebody in a position of power at a university, I would absolutely reject them. But if a trigger warning is chosen by a professor or anybody else voluntarily, that is a matter of freedom of speech, choosing how to present your message in a way that you believe is going to maximize its potential impact on your audience.
So it's like saying, hey, we're going to be reading something, we're going to be watching this movie, mm-hmm. and it's pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Here's what to expect.
And I'm not, different professors in the very same classroom might reach different judgments, but that's a matter of our own own freedom of speech and our own academic freedom.
So what do you say when a student says, like, yeah, I'm out of here because even thinking about this triggers me?
I would try to persuade that student that it's best for his or her education, but I think to actually see the image, but mm-hmm. I would also refer that student to a mental health expert, which I don't purport to have that expertise, mm-hmm. but I've read many psychologists argue that it's actually not good for the mental health of somebody who's gone through a traumatic event to seclude himself or herself from exposure. That for psychological reasons as well as educational reasons, it does more harm than good to avoid encountering those images.
Briefly, talk about the larger culture. You know, my sense of things is that laws, politics, these are lagging indicators. They're downstream from where the culture is. And, you know, it's one thing if, you know, say Kitty Genovese's granddaughter is in a room and you're going to show a movie about the Kitty Genovese story. She's like, you know, I'd rather not sit here. That's one thing. But then when it's something where people, you know, it could be a football story and people are like, I'm triggered because I think football is, you know, racist and imperialist and masculinist or something. There seems to be a sense that we're getting more and more overly sensitive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're really polarized and everybody's going off. How do we reinforce a culture where it's kind of like Eleanor Roosevelt? Eleanor Roosevelt, who in a certain level was very privileged, obviously, mm-hmm. but also took a lot of shit. And she was a really steadfast proponent of civil rights and mm-hmm. of racial integration and whatnot. Like, how do we get back to that, mm-hmm. more of an Eleanor Roosevelt and less of a kind of snowflake mentality?
And in my book, I quote not only Eleanor Roosevelt, but a lot of African-Americans, including Barack Obama and mm-hmm. Van Jones and Ruth Simmons, right. because I think it's very especially credible. They would be more credible role models to African-American students.
But at colleges students. Now, I mean, when you know, half the time it is minority students or mm-hmm. students of associations purporting to represent minority mm-hmm. viewpoints saying, no, you know what, like, I don't want to hear anything that offends me. So what
and
do we do?
And that's why I think it's so important to have the Obamas and the Simmons and the Van Joneses of the world saying, you owe it to yourselves as individuals and to the community that you're representing to develop the ability to withstand whatever efforts the hate mongers are engaging in, to try to silence you, to try to make you feel humiliated. No, you've got to rise above that. And Obama is constantly citing the example of the civil rights demonstrators in the 50s and 60s, Martin Luther King and others who kept saying, you know, hate's not going to drive out hate, only love will do that. And learning to engage with those who were arguing against their civil rights message by hearing them and by responding to them. And you're not going to develop effective arguments unless you listen to them as well. Randy Kennedy, who's an African-American law professor at Harvard and great advocate of civil rights and civil liberties, is working on a whole book about this. And he's holding up the civil rights movement and the students who were so active in that movement as a model to minority students today, that they are just not going to be effective in achieving their goals of reducing racial discrimination and racial injustice unless they learn to answer back, not allow themselves to be silenced or to feel demeaned, but to make society look down on those who are detracting from their equal status.
Final question. You know, I'm of an age where I grew up thinking about the ACLU mm-hmm. and Skokie, Illinois, and, mm-hmm. you know, where neo-Nazis wanted to march through a town with a large Jewish population outside of Chicago. It was made into a terrible, if I may say, a terrible TV movie with Danny Kaye.
I liked that movie.
Well, you know, we'll have to disagree about that, but is it wearying? I mean, to be a free speech, a defender of unfettered free speech, and you're constantly, you have to stand up for the neo-Nazis mm-hmm. and the racists mm-hmm. and the jackasses. Mm-hmm. You know, is it kind of like, I mean, are you like, you know, fuck, can I just... You know, where is Frederick Douglass? You know, where is Margaret Sanger?
Right,
where are people?
And I do have to say, Nick, I'm the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, so I loathe the Nazis even more than I love free speech. Mm-hmm. And it is.
I was going to say, you think you have a special? The Nazis shot my father in World War II. How dare you trump my Nazi hatred? You but know, no, but yeah.
So I have a double stake in this. Yeah. Not only do I believe in freedom of speech as, you know, embodying individual and permitting the development of individual liberty, but I also see it as the essential prerequisite for combating hatred, right? The only verb in my book, if I can show it, is, you'll show it, the only verb in the title of my book is resist. Right. So my message is that we should resist speech, but the more effective as well as the more principled way to do it is through more speech and not through censorship. And even in the Skokie case, there was a large population of Holocaust survivors in Skokie, Illinois, and they made this very poignant compelling argument that they would be subject to psychic harm and there could be potential violence. I mean, that didn't satisfy that demanding test that the Supreme Court laid out, but, you know, even potential speculative harm is a serious problem. And the ACLU's brief in that case pointed out that that was the exact same argument that had been made less than 10 years earlier by Cicero, Illinois, not too far from Skokie, but very different community, where Martin Luther King wanted to lead a civil rights demonstration. And in that community, his views were seen as hateful and dangerous and offensive and causing psychic harm. So when I always reject the description that the ACLU is defending the Nazis. No, we are defending a neutral principle of free speech that benefits equally, in fact, even more so, anti-Nazis as Nazis.
And you mentioned in the book in passing that Canada's hate speech laws, which some people hold up as a model, actually mirror a lot of the pre-Hitler German hate speech code. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you're going to stop the hate that you're looking for through laws is not really, through censorship is not really clear.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Nadine Strossen. She's a law professor, law scholar, and former head of the ACLU. Her latest book is Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Nadine, thanks for
talking. Thank you so much, Nick.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.